It really is good to be back in the church. I love with the people I love. I missed you. It's always a good sign when you're away, when you look forward to getting back, when you're excited to get back. And that certainly was true for me. We had a wonderful time as a family. Thank you for your prayers while we were away. Many of you told me that you'd be praying for me and my rest and for my time with my family and for my family. And it was a good time. I had a blast with the family. I did my best to unplug and retreat. I don't know how good I did at that, but I tried my best. This is a good time. People keep asking me, "Are you rested?" And I keep telling them, "No, I'm not rested. Have you met my children? I just spent 4 weeks with them." But I was able to slip away for a few days for some good time of studying and writing, and most importantly, to spend time with the God that I'm in love with. And during my break each summer, I live in the Psalms. I prioritize the Psalms, and usually the way it works is that God will take one or two in particular and press them down upon my soul, and they stick out as precious and life-giving. And this summer, one of those in particular is Psalm 121. I don't know why I needed this, but I went away on my break, on my time away, really needing to know the Lord is my helper. Perhaps it's just the craziness and demands of pastoral ministry or a young family and all these things together. But I really needed to be assured that the Lord has me, that He's with me, even when I don't feel it, He's with me. Even when my circumstances seem to tell another story, in the stress, in the angst, I really needed God to tell me, "I have you." And so it was that refrain of Psalm 121, "The Lord is your keeper. The Lord will keep you." Again and again, I drank from that truth, that the Lord has me and He is keeping me. And so coming off my break, as I do every summer, I'm going to share just kind of my thoughts on that, what the Lord did in my heart and what He's doing to me, and hopefully it overflows to you. I'm assuming that you need this as well. That's the assumption behind the sermon, is that you do need help. If you don't feel like you need it now, you will sometime. And some of you, many of you probably do feel like you need it. But fundamentally, the fall has turned us all into people who are in need of help. There are seasons, certainly, when we feel that more. Seasons we feel that less. But the truth, the reality is we are all bound together by need. And every single person who is listening to me right now is in desperate need at all times of help. And the question becomes, where will your help come from? I want to do two things with this psalm, and it's really simple. First, and this is just kind of a contextual thing that I feel like I need to do for where we are, I want to first convince you that you do need help, that you do in fact need help. And then secondly, and I'll spend most of the time here, convince you that God alone is your help. But let's start convincing you, perhaps you need convincing, that you do actually need help. Verse 1, "I lift my eyes up to the hills. From where does my help come from?" He's assuming help. This is David looking up to the Judean mountains and rhetorically pondering the question of all questions, where is my help going to come from? Now, we don't know what was going on in David's life, but honestly, it doesn't really matter. You just choose your trouble when it comes to David. His life was filled with them, even though he was king. He had many troubles. He lived in a time and among a people where suffering and affliction were commonplace. And that's still true for most of the world, but in our context, it's a little different. And we need to recognize that and just own it. When you consider the progress and the affluence and the convenience of the modern world that we live in, moments where we actually do indeed come to the end of ourselves, there's nothing left to do except to cry out to heaven. Moments when we come to the end of ourselves and we see and own and recognize our desperation are the exception. They still happen, but they are the exception, not the norm. Now, we shouldn't be ashamed of that or feel guilty about that, but we dare not. Here's the point. And I fear this is happening too much. We dare not be deceived by it, lulled into a false sense of security. It's a really bad sign when the Psalms become a foreign language to God's people. And I fear that happens in my life and from what I hear from others in your life. When we read the Psalms, all of these heartfelt cries for rescue and deliverance from enemies and pleading for peace and comfort and lament over the futility of a fallen world, when we can't relate to that, when the language of the Psalms becomes unfamiliar, we're not seeing things rightly. We've been deceived. We've been blinded by the prosperity of our modern world to think that we can't relate to these heartfelt cries. Now, I recognize some of you, and I need to say this, I recognize some of you right now need no convincing at all. You're in the thick of it. You're in the heat of it. Bitter providence has brought you to the end of yourself, and you know exactly where David is as he looks up to the heavens crying out, "Where will my help come from?" You join him in his desperation, and let us not forget that most Christians around the world need no convincing. As I prayed, I mean, I would not have to preach point number one of this sermon if I was preaching to brothers and sisters in Iraq who are either going to be killed or displaced from their homes. They know what Psalm 21 is after, and all of the other psalms of heartfelt cry. But some of us do. And I recognize that. That's okay. Some of us need to remember just how helpless we are. So let me take a moment and dismantle what I call the false confidence of modern progress. Let me pull back the curtain of prosperity and let us see what's really going on. I want us to just stop for a moment and get scared, okay? Stop for a moment and consider all that we are up against. First, I mean, we have to admit that we live in a fallen, broken world, a world that's under the curse. It's filled with pain and misery. And despite our best efforts to curb the effects of the fall always finds a way to creep into every single person's life. Accidents take place. Tragedies strike. Calamity strikes. Disease happens out of nowhere. Life in a fallen world is lived perpetually on the edge of tragedy, and there is nothing that anybody here can do to stop it. It is the curse of God, and you're not stronger than the curse. It's going to happen. Perhaps tomorrow. Not just a fallen world. We live in a sinful world as well. Whether it be the personal ways that we are sinned against by others, in personal ways, like people lie to us, they abuse us, they slander us, they steal from us, they violate us, you will be harmed by others. You have and you will continue to be harmed by others in deep and lasting ways, sometimes so deep that it won't go away until glory. But it's not just the sin of individual sins against us of man. The cultures and the institutions that man creates bear the same taint of sin. If fallen man creates culture, if fallen man creates institutions, then we must understand that those cultures and institutions will likewise be infused with the same sinful narrative. And certainly they are. Consider the progress of secular atheism with all of its implications that has completely commandeered higher learning. Consider not just the tolerance, but the celebration of sin that is all around us. Consider the marginalization of all religious claims, particularly Christian claims. You do realize that Christianity, well, it probably is already there, but if it's not there, it soon will be in crisis here. You do realize that your grandkids will be fools if they choose to follow Jesus here. Persecuted fools, probably. There's a fallen world, it's a sinful world out there. But lest we forget the prince of this world, who also is involved in this, we actually do believe Satan is real at this church. And you know he hates you, right? He hates you. And you know he has a host of evil forces at his disposal. You realize that, right? And I'll get really personal. I think he hates this church. I think he loathes this church. This growing, vibrant church that preaches the gospel and honors orthodoxy, but at the same time is contextualize and reaching out to the next generation of college students and evangelizing and discipling them, and in this church that has big dreams of redeeming the bluegrass, and we're getting along so well and so much excitement. Do you really think Satan is indifferent to that? It scares me to death as the pastor of this church. I had a friend who came in town and just spent a week with our church and just kind of met the pastors and hung out and came to church. And you know what her one takeaway was? I hope the elderly in this church are praying because Satan is coming here. And listen, I want you here. And I want you involved. But please know that's not a safe invitation. I think it places you in the crosshairs of the Prince of Darkness. Fallen world, sinful world, prince of the world. And we haven't even mentioned your greatest enemy out there, which happens to be you. Forget the world, forget the devil. I'm trying to survive Robert Cunningham here. This old remnant of the old man, this enemy within, these sinful tendencies and impulses that are always lurking and always tempting and always threatening to destroy me and my marriage and my children and this church. And it's not just my sin's ability to destroy that I should fear the most. I have to give an account to the Holy God for that. Listen, Judgment Day is coming, my friends. Every thought, every word, every action, every desire, every motivation, every inclination of the heart must be laid bare before Almighty Justice. And every single person here has to take their turn. Now, are you becoming unsettled? The thunder and lightning is helping. Listen, give way to it. Okay? Give way to it. It's okay. Dwell there. Don't run from helplessness. Don't run from desperation. Dwell upon it. Let it disturb you. And then answer David's question, which now you need to ask. Where will your help come from? Where will you turn? Will you look outward towards fellow man, trusting in the ingenuity and advances and strategies of mankind? Will you look inward, trusting in yourself, your own sufficiency, your own strength, your own fortitude? By the way, that's what every other religion is, right? You're your own help. I mean, God advises you. He's a consultant. He tells you what to do, how to overcome, how to rescue yourself. But ultimately, you help yourself. Will you look down in despair and just throw up your hands in some nihilistic, cynical despondency? There is no hope. There is no help. You're kidding yourself. It's what your depression's telling you. It's what your anxiety's telling you. It's what secularism is telling you. Will you believe that? Or will you, Psalm 121, I will lift up my eyes. I will lift up. I will look up. My help comes from the Lord. Convinced you that you need help. Let me try to convince you. And maybe for the first time for some of you, and maybe for some of you seasoned saints, you just need to hear it again. Let me convince you what the psalm is claiming, that God and God alone is your help. That's the purpose of the psalm. David is very resolute. He has found his help. The first two verses are his kind of declaration. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. And then the rest of the psalm, he moves away from that kind of introspective language and he's speaking out to others. He's actually pleading with others to embrace the same help. You see that change in 1 and 2. He's saying, where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord. And then verse 3, he starts talking about you. Hey, listen, he will not let your foot be moved. He who watches over you will never sleep. He's evangelizing, trying to convince us that God alone is where we should look for help. So let's consider his words. When you're looking for help, you're looking for two things, okay? You need to find the ability to help, and you need to find the willingness to help. If someone has all the ability to help in the world and they're not willing to help, it's useless. If somebody has all the willingness in the world but they don't have the ability to help, it's useless. True help, those two things have to come together. And in the psalm, David is saying the Lord perfectly fulfills both of these requirements. Now, of course, God has the ability, the first half, the ability to help. Listen, he's God, right? And that's assumed. Look at verse 2. My help comes from the Lord, creator of heaven and earth. I think that qualifies him. Why does David add that little descriptor? He is saying, by the way, the one I'm trusting for help also happened to create all that exists. He is the sovereign of all heaven and earth, so of course he has the ability to help. But I don't think it's his ability to struggle that we struggle with. I think it's the second half of this, his willingness. Of course he has the ability. Is he willing? Is he truly willing to get involved and care and protect and help someone like me? In fact, it's precisely the fact that he is the creator and sustainer of heaven and earth that we doubt his willingness to get involved. In other words, he's so high, he's so other, he's so transcendent. Why would he be concerned about me? So his ability only magnifies our doubts of his willingness. I mean, do you care about a tiny little ant walking across the sidewalk? Do you care about the plight of a blade of grass in a vast meadow filled with grasses? And those images don't even begin to express the infinite disparity between God and man. We are little tiny specks of living matter upon a little tiny planet within a seemingly insignificant solar system, within a galaxy that is just one of billions upon billions of galaxies that the triune God brought into existence with the breath of his words. And you think he cares about the dust? Well, the Bible recognizes that line of thinking. It truly does. The Bible is not a flattering book. It understands on the surface how insignificant we look. What is man that thou art mindful of him? In fact, we read it every week. All men are like grass. Their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, the flowers gone. James, our life is a vapor. Here today and gone tomorrow. But here's where the Bible is so remarkable. At the same time, and it almost takes your breath away, at the same time that God recognizes our utter insignificance and smallness, it at the same time gives us a picture of a God who is indeed willing, who cares. What is man that thou art mindful of him? It's a good question. Why would he be mindful of him? But the assumption within that question is, he is mindful. He is mindful of man. God is willing. The Creator does care. In fact, here's what's so amazing about the Bible's picture of God. He cares with unrivaled intimacy and nearness. In other words, the one who is most transcendent is at the same time the one who is most imminent. The one who's the furthest away from you is at the same time the one whose nearness is the closest. Or, I'll put it like this, the one who should care the least cares the most. That's the Bible's vision of God. And that's where the psalm takes us. I just want you to look. Let's just meditate and marvel at the intimacy and the concern and the care of the Creator in Psalm 121. Look at David's words. Yeah, he's the creator of the heaven and earth, but look what he does. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. He will never take a moment off. He doesn't need a break. He doesn't even need to go to sleep. While you sleep, he watches. There is not one second of your existence where he is not fixated upon you. Continue on. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade, your shadow on your right hand. Have you ever tried to get away from your shadow? Good luck. That's the point. You can't get away from God. He is as fixed to you as your shadow on a sunny day. And it's not just that he is there as some kind of feel-good companion. God is your co-pilot. Nonsense. He is there with you at work to protect, to keep from all harm. Look, he says it. The sun will not strike you by day. It recognizes that there's things against us, but he's there next to us. The sun will not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth forevermore. Day or night, it doesn't matter. You're going out, you're coming in, it doesn't matter. He is there to keep you. I love that language, as I said. That's the word I couldn't get away from. Six times in this little psalm, keep. The Lord will keep you. The Lord will keep you. Keep, keep, keep. He doesn't just watch over you, he keeps you. He doesn't just come when you need him or even when you want him, he keeps you. You don't keep him, you don't hold on to him, he keeps you. So here's the picture from David. The omnipotent, transcendent, sovereign of all existence is at the same time intimately, steadfastly, unwavering, never slumbering, never sleeping, at all times, every second, intimately and perfectly keeping you. Now that is absolutely glorious if it's true. But I think even the most seasoned saint struggles at times to believe it's true. Or at least not to the extent of 121, Psalm 121. I mean, that's the point, right? Maybe we believe he cares. Maybe believe he thinks of us. Maybe we believe that he is some way orchestrating life and providence in some ethereal way. But the level of Psalm 121, that's what we struggle with, right? The depths of concern and care, that's what we struggle with. You know why? Because our circumstances seem to be telling another story. I mean, let's play cynic for a moment, shall we? The Lord is your keeper. Really? Because sometimes I feel like nobody has me. The Lord will neither slumber nor sleep. Really? Sometimes I feel like he is totally checked out on my life. Sleep at the wheel. The Lord will not let your foot be moved. Really? Because right now I feel like I'm in an utter tailspin. The Lord will keep you from all evil. Really? Evil all about me. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth forevermore. Really? Because at times I feel utterly forsaken. So here's what we have. We have Psalm 121 telling us one story. And then we have our feelings. We have our circumstances, or at least our interpretation of our circumstances, telling us another story. What do we do with that? Well, here is where looking to God for help, and this is what makes looking to God for help unique. It demands, it necessitates faith. Trust, surrender, and all these different things. Where does your help come from? If that answer is God, then you have chosen. I'm sorry, this is just the way it is. If you choose God, then you have chosen a help whose ways are not your ways, who has a perspective you don't have, who has desires for your life that may not line up with your desires for your life. And if you want his help, then you're going to have to let him help on his terms and not yours. I'm sorry, that's just the nature of looking to God for help. It has to be on his terms, not yours. So here's the point. The good news about looking to God for help is that he's God, right? And he knows infinitely more than you how to help you. The scary news about looking to God for help is that he's God. And he knows infinitely more than you how to help you. It's both glorious and scary at the same time to trust in God. It's glorious because he's God and he knows what he's doing and he knows more than I do. It's scary because he's God and he knows what he's doing and he knows what I do. And at times they don't line up. My son was crying to me a couple days ago. He's hungry. He said, "I'm starving." Always so dramatic. "I'm starving." So I gave him something to eat. "Well, that's not what I wanted." "Okay, well, what do you want?" "I would like candy for breakfast, pizza for lunch, and candy for dinner." You like the variety there? At least he inserted pizza. "Well, because I love you, because I'm steadfastly committed to caring for you, I would never do that. Ever. if you want me to feed you, you're going to have to let me feed you. Could it be that within our cries for help, we don't even know what help looks like? Could it be that the capacities of the finite cannot comprehend the designs of the infinite? I mean, is that possible? Can we just consider that for a moment? It's okay. I mean, I didn't get mad at my child for wanting candy and pizza. I understand that he's being honest with his own desires, and that's his capacities, and that's what he's able to understand, and he's just being honest with his dad. But at the same time, I'm not going to indulge that. I care way too much to do things his ways. My ways aren't his ways, and I'm going to do it my way. So to join David in lifting our eyes to God for help is an act of surrender, where we choose to let God be God and help on his own terms. But, and this is very important, and this is what sets the Christian gospel apart, okay? It's not blind surrender. It's not blind trust. Because God has demonstrated definitively that he is worthy of our trust, that he does care, that he's willing to get involved, that our cries for help have been heard. He's demonstrated that definitively. I think, you know, if you're super cynical, a secular cynical, maybe even here, I know what you would say to this gathering. I know what they would say to this church. All you religious people who need your religious crutch, and it just makes you feel better to deal with life, to imagine there's a God up there who cares and he's orchestrating all of this out. And you can get up there in the pulpit and you can tell all these people that there is a God and he helps you. You may not be able to understand it, but it's all working out in some divine plan. Very convenient, right? How do we know? How do we know? You can level that charge against every religion except ours. We know he has demonstrated definitively that he is worthy of our trust, that he does care. Why? The Lord got involved. That word keep is so prominent. Again, I keep coming back to it. Keep. The Lord will keep you. He is your keeper. Keep, 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 keep. And that was so good for me. But do you know what verse I kept thinking about as I dwelt upon the word keep? The Lord will keep me. He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. The only person that God has ever let go of was his own son. My God, why have you forsaken me? That's the cry of Golgotha. Why have you forsaken me? You can answer that question now, can't you? That he might keep me. That he might keep you. So that Psalm 121 isn't wishful thinking towards a disinterested deity. It is concrete, certifiable, undeniable truth that you can bank your everlasting soul upon. So we may not be able to understand his help, but because of Calvary, we never have to doubt his help. We may not be able to grasp his ways, but we know what his ways are not. It can't be that he doesn't care, because he cared enough to give up his son. It can't be that he doesn't love you. He loved you enough to give up his son. It can't be that he isn't committed. He is so committed that he gave up his son. It can't be that he is going to fail in his protection of you. He gave up his son to succeed. Don't you see? We may not be able to understand Psalm 121, but because of Jesus, we know Psalm 121 is true. What that means is you can just let your heart go to all these promises. It's true. Indulge it. He's with you. He will keep you. No matter what, you cannot escape him. He neither slumbers nor sleeps. He is fixated upon you. He is at work. He has you, Christian. I don't care what your circumstances are saying, or your emotions, or what your depression is whispering to you, or the evil one is whispering to you. I don't care what they are saying to you. I'm telling you, by the authority of Jesus Christ who got involved, God has you and he will keep you. Now, wouldn't that change things if you actually believe that? I mean, out of here and down into here. You know what I'm saying? If you actually, that became your breath. that you believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that He is with you, that He has you. It is inescapable. Would that not change things? Could you not endure anything if we knew for certain that He has us? Well, in Jesus, you know for certain. He has you. And every time you doubt that, like David lifted his eyes to the hills, you lift your eyes to the hill of Calvary, where truly our help comes from, because it was there where God gave up His Son that He might keep you forever. Amen. Let me pray.